You're 22. Now, what was this new posting you were to take up, and when did you take it up?
It was a very exciting new posting because I was to run the Vernon long course in torpedo and anti-submarine warfare. I was appointed to join Vernon from the 10th of March, 1952, and the course was going to start in April. Well, because the battle acts have been refitting at Portsmouth, I've been able to do a certain amount of trips to and fro to Vernon to find out what the form was and who was going to be on the course. And I found that they were not actually joining Vernon for another 2 or 3 months after March. They were going up to the Royal Naval College, Greenwich, to do their theoretical training. So I had some time after I joined Vernon to actually plan the details of the course.
How did you do that?
There hadn't been many of these courses. I personally had done the second ever course in this form. And so I spent a lot of time talking to the people, the specialists in Vernon, who were running particular bits of the place, the torpedo side, the anti-submarine side, and so on. And I also went up to Greenwich in order to meet all the youngsters and younger people, young lieutenants on the course that I was to run. And I had to produce a daily training program every day for about a year ahead of the time when they came down to Vernon as to where we'd be, what we'd be doing, what the syllabus was, who'd be teaching it, and so on. If I couldn't teach the whole lot myself, that'd be out of the question. And that included going back down to Portland in order to use the anti-submarine school Osprey there and the submarines and frigates who took people to sea in training courses, and to take them up to Londonderry for the joint anti-submarine training, and to go and live at St. Evil, the Coastal Command air base in Cornwall. So there was a very great deal of planning to do, and it took a heck of a long time, and I got more and more worried about whether I was going to make mistakes over it. However, we now had bought a house for the first time in Leon Salient, and I was at least happily based at home while I was doing all these things from the Vernon point of view. And by the time the course, the young lieutenants came down there, there were Canadians and Australians, as well as English chaps on the course, all lieutenants. I found that they were very high-spirited indeed, and the greatest fun to lead from that point of view. And to help me run this course, I had a gunner, a warrant officer, and also a chief petty officer, who were excellent people. Well, before we get on to what the course was all about, there were various social activities which occurred as part of it. One of them was that traditionally there had been terrible ill feeling between the gunnery officers at Excellent and the torpedo officers at Vernon. And there had been such violence in some of the arguments that had occurred over the decades beforehand that it had been agreed that there would be an annual Olympiad, where every other year you would challenge these people to a contest. And it fell to me to issue the challenge to Excellent, HMS Excellent. And so I talked to the young lieutenants, and we decided that the thing to do was to take Father Neptune into the college, into the gunnery school, and to parade our people in fancy dress and really challenge them to the Olympiad in a very formal way by dropping a gauntlet 5 or 6 feet long, clutching a scroll, which challenged them in verbal terms as well, and to have Neptune coming through a great cloud of water to actually declaim the challenge verbally, which was written on the thing. And we didn't warn them when this was happening. It had to be during the week starting something or other. And I got hold of the Portsmouth Fire Brigade and obtained their collaboration. So they gave me not only a fire engine, but also a Victorian silver fire chief's helmet to wear in their fire engine. And we also had some small trucks, which were enclosed, And I borrowed from the dockyard a very large truck indeed, where I could secure torpedoes alongside it, one each side. And I arranged that my course would dress up as Father Neptune's acolytes, complete with mermaids' tails and so on. I persuaded the fire engine to fire people to treat it as an emergency and to drive through Portsmouth with their sirens blowing. And we were followed by this very large lorry with the torpedoes and the mermen sitting on them with their tails over the side. And also by the little van. And in the van, we had Father Neptune and two or three of his acolytes dressed in frog suits. Father Neptune himself just wore seaweed, not much else. And, of course, a trident carried and a crown and all the rest of it. And because the sentries on the causeway to get into Whale Island were not expecting this and saw a fire brigade coming, fire engine coming along, with me sitting in the front ringing the bell, they all got out of the way and let us by, which they shouldn't have done if they'd stuck to their own rules. So we got up onto the fields in front of the wardroom. The fireman knew exactly where to connect the hoses. And in no time flat, we had a huge curtain of water coming down outside the wardroom at lunchtime. Carefully chosen at lunchtime, and everybody rushed out and immediately got soaked with the water coming down, including the captain, which I worried about a little bit, but not too much. And then there rumbled up the torpedoes, and behind that a crane lorry, and dangling from the crane was the 5-foot gauntlet touching the actual challenge. And so this was eventually dropped at the feet of the captain, but we'd also borrowed a Canadian thunder flash, which made a noise like a Stuka dive bomber before it exploded. And this made the captain jump back, and one or two of the other officers jump back. They thought that something was going to explode near them. And the whole thing went jolly well. Then we all had a drink and went home. They had to return the acceptance of the challenge. And my chum, who'd my tennis partner, actually was gunner officer running the course, and he decided to deliver his reply to the challenge by converting a naval cutter into a pirate ship and fitting a cannon at the end of it. And he invaded Vernon Creek, making bang noises, and delivered his acceptance of the challenge. And then we got on and played all the games there were between the long gunnery course and the long TAS course.
What sort of games? I mean,
Everything from tug of war to touch football and touch rugger, rather, and cricket and the lot. And then we had guest night, which was at Whale Island, where we did various things which were actually covered by hurt certificates if you got damaged in the course of doing it. We did a somersault over the back of a sofa and hit a chair which was with its back on the floor. If you hit it just right, it came upright and left you sitting in the chair pointing in the other direction. Nobody was seriously damaged. I sprained an ankle a bit trying to get round the whole wardroom without touching the floor at all, because I fell off something. But it was a very good party, and it was very good for morale, and it meant that we got to know a lot of the courses, got to know a lot of their contemporaries who just happened to be gunnery officers rather than undersea warfare specialists.
So there wasn't so any. It had worked.
It worked. Over many years it had worked. And there was certainly competition, and the undersea warfare people had for years, and indeed during the war felt very strongly that they were regarded as an inferior race to the gunnery officers who were always promoted, weren't they? And the effect during the war was that we were not prepared for the submarine offensive. We just were not very good at it, which was sad. Well, the course got underway, and eventually we had children's parties and things like that were run also at Vernon. But nobody ever forgot the Olympiad and the delivery of the challenge, because it was a rather a formidable event involving captains and so on. My captain thought it was terribly funny that the other captain had got a wet shirt out of it. I don't think the other captain thought it quite so funny. During this course, the Commander-in-Chief wished to exercise the Portsmouth Command in defending it against espionage and people who might come and damage facilities. And so he announced that for a particular week, we could anticipate that there would be infiltrators, and we would take particular trouble to do this, to make certain that nobody actually got in. Then I was sent for and told that I would be responsible for being and organizing the infiltrators, and that I had my long course to act with me to do this thing. So we sat around a table, and I said what I would like to do would be to assassinate the Commander-in-Chief, to infiltrate some very secret intercept radio station, and to find out what they were doing, because I knew that I wasn't allowed to know that. And that I thought it'd be rather fun to tweak the noses of the Royal Marines and the Royal Marine Barracks at Eastleigh. And so my 18 young lieutenants and my chief petty officer and my warrant officer all thought this would be rather fun. And we planned how to do it. Well, one of my officers had a great gift with a pen and ink, and he forged an identity card for himself. I, who was thought to have more brass neck than some of the others, decided that I would borrow a helicopter on a false name and a false identity card from the air station at Leon Soland, say that it was part of the Commander-in-Chief's exercise, and that I wished to fly, first of all, down the coast, which took me over Eastleigh Barracks, where the Royal Marines were, and then off to Winchester, which I knew was near a particular radio station, which I thought was doing secret work. I then arranged that one or two of my people went to the civil establishment in Farum, where the works department kept all the working drawings of the naval establishments around, and we managed to find out where the cable runs were to the wireless establishment. The brief I had said I could do any damage consistent with breaking in. And so we decided that we would take a number of the young officers up to Worthy Down, and the wives produced the cars, and sometime after midnight we launched these chaps with their blackened faces to make their way in, because I had the photographs by then showing exactly where the places were. And one of the huts in use had not yet had the wall completed around it. But one of my young officers, who subsequently became an equerry to the Queen, had twisted his ankle. So he couldn't do anything clandestinely. So he went in there dressed in number 8s, which was the ratings working uniform, and pretended to be drunk and walked around the huts. We'd found the numbers of the huts by then. And he persuaded the sailors there, the radio operators and so on, that he was genuine, that he really was tight. And so they took him in and looked after him. Meanwhile, the others went around tying labels on to the aerials, saying, this is a bomb which exploded at a certain time. And one or two of them went to the hut we'd identified without the wall completed around it, and took some papers out of an in-basket on somebody's desk. They broke in through a window. The same night, my forger got into the naval headquarters and went up to the Commander-in-Chief, smartly under Portsdown Hill, headquarters was, went up to the Commander-in-Chief and said, I've got this for you, sir, and saluted very smartly. Oh, what is it, said the Commander-in-Chief, took it from his hand, it was a note, and said, I have just assassinated you. And the Commander-in-Chief took it awfully well. I didn't know it at the time. And down the other end of Portsmouth at Eastleigh, we had arranged that my gunner and a young Wren, who was cooperative, would be spending 2 or 3 days that week on the beach, just on the beach side of Eastleigh, making lovey-dovey noises to each other, but actually timing when the sentries were operating and where they were operating. And eventually, on the night in question, he took some boat croppers in his trousers. And at the appropriate moment, when the sentries crossed over and opened up, he opened up the wire. And my chaps who were going in there got in from the beachside. And they caused absolute mayhem. They took away the breech of one gun and one of the parts of the operating system of a radar. And some of them were caught by the Royal Marines and locked up in an oilskin locker or something. And so they broke through the ceiling of that and then broke out through the tiles on the top and got away. And so one way and another, we had considerable success. But how considerable the success was, I didn't know until I looked at the papers, which had been stolen from the radio station, because I discovered that they were far too secret for me to be allowed to read them, let alone anything else. Well, we were all in the car. The wives were waiting outside the radio station. And there was one more chap who hadn't turned up. And so we were all having coffee at 2 or 3 in the morning, rather wet because it had been very dewy in the long grass. And a police car drove up behind us, and another one stopped in front of us. And I had a piece of paper which said that I wasn't responsible for anything. This was only an exercise which I could use in an emergency. We tried to bluff our way out of it. And the local Mr. Plod came up and said, "Evening, sir." He said, "Evening, constable." "Having a good time, sir?" "No, not very. It's jolly wet sailing. We couldn't bear it anymore. We just stopped and had some coffee. Would you like a cup of coffee?" And he swallowed it absolutely whole. And we were getting away with it when the last chap burst out of the ditch beside the car, not seeing the policeman, and said, "I've blown the transformer house to hell." And had I not had that piece of paper, which excused me from all those things, I'd have spent the night in Winchester jail, I think. But when I saw these papers, I realized I had to stay with those personally. And I went to call the Commander-in-Chief at 8 o'clock the next morning with the papers and said, "I'm terribly sorry, sir. We're not entitled to get these, but this is what happened." He said, "Well, I'm not here. You've assassinated me, you remember." And he was a lovely man, Admiral Woods.
Admiral Woods?
Admiral Woods, I think it was. So it was, for morale purposes, it was a wonderful way of getting these young lieutenants together. From the point of view of actually tackling the security of the place, we demonstrated that there were holes in the system, which was what it was all about anyway. And we had, with the Australians and Canadians and all the rest of it, who were pretty wild, some of them, and so one or two of ours, we demonstrated that we could do a job together and to do it rather well. And these chaps all passed their examination. The sort of entertainment, I had the complete Olympiad, music, menu, dinner thing, all the rest of it from Whale Island, which they'd done with a cruise missile of some sort from the gunnery school, attacking a torpedo which has just been sunk, because they wished to demonstrate that they were actually better than we were still. So a great competition. So that was the end of the long course. And of course
you just did one, did you?
Just one, yes. One.
So when would that finish?
53. I had a part-time job given to me in Vernon when they'd finished the long course itself, because it was coronation year, and there was the fleet review at Spithead coming up that autumn, and we all had jobs to do. Vernon was to act as the major landing place for the nobs who were going out to sea, like the Russian ambassador and those sort of people, Foreign Office man, Vyshinsky and so on. And I got the job of organizing the landing place, which was, it was interesting to see the fleet coming, and Peggy went out to spend some time in a Canadian destroyer with friends. And one way and another, the Italian sail training ship, the Amerigo Vespucci, brought polio to Portsmouth and brought it to my landing place in Vernon. And there were six of us who were concerned with that landing place caught polio, and I was one of them. The other five were dead in 48 hours, and I wasn't expected to live and was in Haslar, the naval hospital. And the my captain, the Vernon Captain Copeman, who was a lovely man, was brave enough to come and see me, because the fact that polio was catching had been all too obvious, the fact that so many of us caught it in one place. And it was very brave of him to do this thing, and I very much appreciate it, but it wasn't really making an awful lot of sense. And they didn't know for about 8 or 10 days whether or not I was going to live or not, because I couldn't swallow at all, and I wasn't really with it. And Peggy came in every day to sit with me as well. And it was presumed that I was going to die as the others had done. So it was quite extraordinary to be resurrected, really, after that.
How long did it take you to recover?
I was left, I couldn't speak because my vocal cords were in a mess. And one of my legs lost most of the calf muscle, my right leg lost most of the calf muscle, and I didn't have any spring left in my right foot at all. But I was sent home after about 2 or 3 weeks in hospital. And one day, cleaning my teeth at home, I noticed that when I tried to lift my lips open to clean my front teeth, only this side went up and this side didn't. And as I was looking, my left eyelid dropped and I couldn't open it. And so I went back into hospital, screeching back into hospital, and said, "You sent me home with this ruddy bug, and I've got two young children in the house, and I'm dashed off, I'm going to stay there." So there was a time while I was making a fuss in the hospital. But by September that year, I was sufficiently good to have a holiday with Peggy to recover. As I couldn't walk properly, we decided the best thing to do would be to take a boat on the Thames, so at least I could drive the boat. He'd do all the jumping about. And so we took a boat in September for a week that year, which I recorded at the time as being perfect convalescence. But I wasn't really fit for sea duty. And therefore, they had to find some job for me after that, which was suitable for a chap who wasn't firing on all cylinders. I found out that I got my voice back in the early autumn when I saw Peggy backing the car onto a stump outside our house in Leon Soland. I suddenly found I could shout after all. And I was attached to an analysis team of a big NATO exercise called Mariner. And with quite a lot of other people in one of the forts out on Portsdown Hill, underground there, we collected all the records from Mariner, which covered the whole of the North Atlantic. From the ocean point of war, and it covered mine warfare in the North Sea and so on, and went all the way down to the Mediterranean as well. And I spent 2 or 3 months buried under Portsdown Hill analyzing the anti-submarine records. That was my special specialization. And then we were invited, because my voice had come back, invited a team of altogether 10 of us, were invited to present the results. And we had to present them first to the Supreme Allied Commander Europe, SACEUR, in Versailles, and then we were going to present it at Royal Naval College Greenwich to everybody they could collect together in this country. And then they were in Norfolk, Virginia, where the Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic had his headquarters. And this was really quite an exciting thing to be doing, because as a lieutenant commander, I found that I was actually addressing groups of people of flag rank or very senior army rank or whatever in all these places. And it wasn't a totally English course. There were Americans on it. There were Englishmen. There was a coastal command chap. There was a Dutchman called Bill Elfrick, and one of our submariners. And in Europe, we had a rather disinterested team of soldiers listening to what was rather essentially a maritime war. The point being, we were trying to draw their attention to the difficulty of reinforcing Europe if there was full-scale opposition to it. However, when we'd done the presentation, it had seemed to go off all right, and Sakya had duly stood up and said thank you, and all the brass had gone out of the way, I decided I'd go out for an evening on the town. And I started with a cousin of Peggy's who lived out at Versailles. And then I met the submariner in town, and we went into a pub where they spoke English, just opposite the one of the more famous nightclubs in Paris. And we found on the wall a whole lot of English old-school ties, old Italian ties, old rugby ties, and all the rest of it. And we thought this was rather extraordinary. And we said, well, where shall we go for dinner? I said, before we talk about dinner, you're going to have a drink, and you're going to have this drink and that drink. Then I will tell you where to have dinner. And then come back and tell me how the dinner is, and I'll tell you how to go on from there. So he set up our whole evening, and we had our drinks. I just avoided having my tie cut off by his scissors. And we went to La Reine Pédoc, where we had, I think, 10 courses of food. And with each course, for the two of us, they provided a large bottle of wine each. And it was clearly up to us how much we drank. And it was a marvelous evening there. So we got back to the pub in very good flying order. And they said, would we like to go across to the, I forgot the name of the place, but anyway, the particular nightclub. And we were shown across by the chap's wife, who talked us in there for nothing, because her best customers were got in for nothing, didn't they? And we couldn't find a table. So we got a drink at the bar, and we went down and we sat on the front of the stage. And they were doing their can-can and all that sort of thing all over our heads, sitting on the front of the stage, which was great fun. We thought it was terribly funny. And as the dance finished, and that act finished, rather to our surprise, the stage withdrew with us sitting on it. We finished up on the same side of the curtain as all the girls had been dancing can-can. So we chatted with them, and our French by then was much more fluent, perhaps, than it had been earlier on in the evening. And so we went back to our mentor in the pub, and he said, well, now you've seen that, now you must go down to this one, and then you must go down to that one. So we set off, well, after midnight by then. And we went to a place, there was nowhere to sit again, so we went down to the band and said, look, we'd take over the bits of the band and, you know, just give me your drumsticks and so on. And they shrugged in a Gallic way and left us to it in the middle of the band. And to my considerable alarm, I realized that nearly all the chaps on the stage playing their parts were in fact girls dressed as chaps. And the other ones were girls dressed as girls. So we thought that was very weird and decided not to go there anymore. So we asked in that place where we go. They said, oh, second on the right, third on the left, and you go to this particular place. So we went down there, and we found that all the girls were in fact chaps. And it was quite the reverse. And we said, no, we thought that was terribly un-English. So we went out the streets about 4 a.m, something like that, whereupon we were had at by pickpockets and those sort of people. And we found ourselves running like hell to get into the daylight. And we caught our planes home to England. I'm happy to say we got away without having anything stolen and without being put in jail ourselves.